right. We are now recording. Marianne, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me. And if you could just start with your name.
My name is Mary Ann Weese, W-E-E-S-E, Lundy, L-U-N-D-Y.
Thank you very much. And are you lay or clergy?
I'm lay, but I'm a graduate of Union Theological Seminary with a Master's of Divinity, Union Seminary in New York City.
Yes.
And my degree was in 1957 when there were very few women there.
Yes. That's amazing. I just have to ask, what led you to go to Union in that year?
What led me to go to seminary? I'm
yes.
a graduate of West Virginia University, and nobody in my family ever went to seminary. They were Presbyterians. My father was a Presbyterian elder and took that very seriously. But when I finished college, I said I had this, I had, during my junior year, decided I wanted to go to seminary and began to look at seminaries and thought I would, everybody thought I would go to Princeton. That's where everybody went. And McCormick offered me a scholarship, and I got to know about Union, and some students came through from Union and convinced me that I ought to be going to Union. So I really, really had decided. I turned everything down by then. I wanted to go to Union. That was it.
Wow.
But then I wasn't sure I could get in. Because I had had one religion course in college. We didn't have a religion department. So it was a little iffy there for a while. And I always have had the feeling somebody, some other woman, there were five of us in our graduating class, 65 men.
Wow.
Five women. Phyllis Tribble was my roommate. That gives you some idea.
Really?
Biff Harrison was one of my friends. And then other person. So we were a stalwart group, but it's still, we were very small.
Wow. I just have to ask, Marianne, first of all, what led you to think about seminary? What were you going to seminary for?
Well, I had, it's very interesting. It wasn't the church so much as I was a part of the student YWCA.
Mm.
And the student YWCA in the 50s was on about 50 campuses. And it was the women's leadership body. I had joined it as a student. And then the kinds of social justice issues that we were dealing with, we were dealing with women's leadership roles, and had 400 members in our student Y on Wednesday evenings. I mean, it was really very, very effective. Student YM was, too.
Yeah.
And so I was convinced I wanted to be a layperson in ministry and in campus ministry.
Mm.
And so that was why I wanted to do it ecumenically. I was already very much convinced about that. So that led me to Union.
Oh.
And if I didn't get in Union, I wasn't going anywhere else.
Really?
It was pretty crazy. And my parents were just very concerned. They thought any seminary was a very conservative place. And that they, you know, they were really concerned that I'd come home kind of wacky. and said to me, if you come home at Christmas and you're really over the hill, please can we say you won't go back? And so I said, sure. they had no idea what the state of Union was. So
wow. Oh, Marianne, that is wonderful.
A little crazy.
Yeah, yeah. And what
I have to say, I had a distant aunt who was a fundamentalist minister in Peoria, Illinois. And that was on my father's side. So he had some reason to think maybe, you know, I might come home a little goofy. He was concerned about that.
So just to clarify, when he was afraid of you being wacky or goofy, he was afraid of you becoming fundamentalist?
Yeah, uh-huh, yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, she would come to visit us, and she'd sit on our front porch, and my brother and I'd be coming back from school. We could hear her a block away. She was and she was she talked about her love token. She drove a Chrysler Imperial and wore a big hat and had a church, her own church.
Wow.
And Orlena was some character. And so I think my father thought, you know, she may end up being like in Orlena.
So what was her name again?
Weese,
W-E-E-S-E. Okay. Oh, I love that.
My
That's great.
My father was a teacher. All my family were educators.
Okay.
Public school teachers, pre-Revolutionary War. They all were teachers.
Wow.
So
what...
That was...
Go ahead.
That was thought to be okay.
Yes.
A teacher.
Right. Not seminary. So what was your experience at Union like, Marianne?
Well, since Phyllis Tribble was my roommate, we had a great time. I mean, it was hard. It was extremely hard for me. But I was also, I just felt like it was the most exciting, interesting, incredible time that I could ever have thought it to be. And it just, every day was just so exciting. And Niebuhr was still there, so we studied ethics with Niebuhr, Dr. Meilenberg. So I was very, along with Phyllis, absolutely committed to biblical studies. And they used to talk about, our classmates would say, Phyllis was the student and I was the people person. And they used to make Beverly Harris furious. She'd say, no, you can study, you're good. Anyway, it was fun. A little out of hand here, I think.
Oh, it is, but it's really important. It's really good. So, what work or ministry were you doing at the time of reimagining?
After I was in campus ministry in several places, then we were at the University of Idaho, the University of Illinois, then I was with the National YWCA for 5 years. I was the director of National Student YWCA, commuting to Minneapolis, where my family, my husband was a minister. And the Presbyterian Church was reorganizing, I guess is the way to say it. The South and the Northern streams had been separated at the Civil War, and so when they came back together, they hired new staff persons for the new structure. And I had applied to be director of the Women's Ministry Unit. And I had done a lot of work in the church, chairing task forces, et cetera. And this made it, I'd been on national committees of the Council on Women in the Church. And so I applied, and I got, there were 9 positions for the leadership of the church, and I was hired for the women's position, the director of the women's unit. We had 4 groups, women employed by the church, women of color, justice for women, and Presbyterian women, which was the traditional group. And this unit brought all of them together. So that was what sort of put me on the national stage in terms of women's issues and women in the church.
Before we move on to reimagining your role to that, which was absolutely crucial, could you talk about when and how you became aware of feminist theology?
Oh, yeah. Well, I think it was as much through the YWCA as it was through the church. You know, the Y doesn't get the credit for being an incredibly important religious lay body. And so a lot of the reading I had done, a lot of the work in terms of social justice had been through the Y. And the term feminist theology, when we had been at the University of Idaho, I had led a group of women studying Betty Friedan and the feminist mystique. And those conversations, and then being on task forces for women within the Presbyterian Church, working on issues of ordination and placement for women, I was also at the General Assembly in 1956 when the Presbyterian Church voted in General Assembly to ordain women for the first time as clergy. They had ordained women as lay leadership from the 30s. Actually, that General Assembly was in Minneapolis, St. Paul, interestingly enough. Part of it, my commitment was very strong to the nature of social justice and then moving that into racial justice and feminist theology and feminist studies. So, yeah, by the time I took the job for the Presbyterian Church, I'd been pretty much involved in regional and national task forces on women in the church.
Great. Thank you. Well, that brings us to, you were absolutely crucial in the formation of the Reimagining Conference. Could you say, talk about how that happened?
Yeah, it happened when we got involved with the Ecumenical Decade, Churches in Solidarity with Women, which had been set up by the World Council of Churches in 1988, trying to bring a realization to the churches of feminist theology of the place of women, and to make that more crucial, really, with churches worldwide. So that committee was set up. We as Presbyterian women knew that we needed to be an important part of that, particularly since the Presbyterian Church had sort of been a theological backbone. The Reformed churches had been of the World Council of Churches and the ecumenical movement. So we started to look at what could we do, what were we as women who were Presbyterian and Reformed, that what could be our place, what could be our best contribution. And right away we said theology, that's always our thing. And so what could we do that would be unique, that would be a gift to the church. And so we wrote, we were just moving from the old structure as a United Presbyterian Church into the Presbyterian Church USA. And the former staff were still there. Aurelia Foulet, Mary Virginia Steve Hales, and I met in an office. We were still in New York. We hadn't gone to Louisville yet. And we, one afternoon, I called them together and said, we need to decide what could we do that would really be wonderful for the ecumen. And they knew about the decade, but none of us had worked on it. This must have been 1988. Yeah. And we came up with this idea of a theological colloquium. So we wrote up a proposal, and we were in the midst of a bicentennial campaign to raise capital funds for the church. And we submitted that. I wrote the proposal. We went over and over it. Finally submitted it, and it was accepted. And there were a number of, I think we submitted 7 proposals, actually. And they were, 3 of them, I think, were accepted right away. And this one was the one that we followed through with, which was a international theological colloquium that would have more women, as many women speakers from abroad as there were women from our own country. It was an effort to say, we need to listen to women in the rest of the world. What is it that they are doing theologically that is a gift to us? And then how can we speak also about the whole, the real emphasis was that we were there to hear, to listen, to become a part of the worldwide feminist movement in the churches. And we were particularly aware of the women in Africa. We weren't sure about other areas, as in Eastern Europe, but that was why we wanted to get people who could come, women who could come and help us. It was to be an all-women's conference. our first proposal was that it would be a small group, maybe a couple of hundred people, and we would meet. We had some interesting ideas in the beginning that we would all meet in families, round tables. That part that was carried over in the final feminist theology in the Reimagining Conference.
Yes.
But we said that was absolutely necessary. So then we took the written proposal to the Bicentennial Commission. It was accepted. Mm-hmm. And then we decided that we would need to give it, if it was going to be really effective, it needed to be given to a local decade committee. And there were four that I visited. There was a decade committee in the Bay Area in San Francisco. There was one in Atlanta. There was one in Detroit. And there was one in Minneapolis. Mm. And I met with them, talking about what the possibilities were, what they were interested in doing. And the one in Minneapolis turned out to be the best organized. It was already in going. The one in Atlanta was too. Detroit had already chosen what it was going to deal with. So Sally Hill was a good friend of mine. Mm-hmm. Sally and I've worked together and known each other for a long time. And she was the Council of Churches staff. And so I called her and I said, Sally, I have this proposal. What are you doing with Decade Committee? And we talked a long time. And she said, well, they were more interested in doing something local, that they were going to send teams out through the presbytery and make some decision about what the possibilities would be. And I said, well, in the meantime, let me send you this proposal, because it seems to me this may be something, knowing the Twin Cities and knowing how I've lived there and the general feeling and commitments, maybe this would work for you. So I sent her the proposal, and we talked several times on the phone. And she said she had sounded out some other people and that she thought they would be interested in it. And so I had said then that we would supply the seed money to start it, if the Presbyterians would. And so that's how the whole thing got started. And then their committee was already organized, but not fully. You know, they were still deciding what to do. So they took it and ran. And I would go when I could. I was based in Louisville. So when I either would go home to see my family, or I have a son and a daughter in the Twin Cities. Then we would make some more decisions, and I would sit with the planning committee. And they sent me, through Sally, all their written reports. I'm not sure the committee ever knew that, but that I, you know, would receive their written report, their meeting reports.
Yeah.
And so I felt like I was a part of the planning of it. But I didn't see specifically things like the worship services. I would get snippets, you know, and then I'd come. And I was at the meeting the time that we decided to call it Reimagining. We were meeting at the church center, and Sally was writing on the board. And I used to kid her because I said, Sally, you can't spell. she wrote Reimagining instead of Reimaging, which we were talking about using Reimagining as the... And then we said, well, is that a word, Reimagining? Well, gosh, maybe that sounds good, doesn't it? Yeah, that'd be better. That's more visionary. So that was how that happened.
Oh, that is great. How did it evolve? I mean, it started out, it was going to be 200. How did it keep going to become what it did?
Yeah, we started talking about it, and we wrote, it really came more through the vision of the committee there in Minneapolis. Part of it was also when we began to ask speakers, and when we realized what we might want to do, when we thought about worldwide speakers, we actually, I sent Sally names, and would talk with people in seminaries and in terms of the international people who ought to be there. And so that's how the beginning of it. I would send her names, and then they would vet them in some way and decide if that was the way they would work. So then we paid for 22 international participants, that is the Presbyterian Church, through the Women's Unit. And some of them couldn't come, of course, and, you know, we did a lot of back and forth. But Sally was my main contact through that. She and I pretty much, I don't know from her, but from the two of us would make the decisions on which people should come and speak. And then pretty much the format was sort of laid out in that original proposal. And the committee tried to be careful in it being a colloquium, that is, a real sharing of information. And then the other thing that we as Presbyterians kept to was we had said in the original proposal that all the papers would be published, and that we felt that we really wanted them to be used in local communities, that was the most important thing, was being able to, as widely as we could, send out the information study guides. And of course we had no idea how many people would come, and it just kept growing. And then it was to have been a couple of years earlier, and we weren't ready, and the committee wasn't ready, the committees there weren't ready, and so the date got changed. And then we began to realize that it was going to be huge, that there were a lot of people who wanted to come. And then it moved from the original proposal of having it really be printed papers to being a huge gathering. And at first, we in the National Office of the Church had some concern about that, because we really had thought it would be much easier to disseminate things more widely if there were a smaller group. I think, of course, it also turned out I was chairing the U.S. Committee of the Ecumenical Decade with a bishop of the Methodist Church, Mayo. And we met, I guess, maybe every 3 months or so. I had with representatives of most of the denominations, and it was a great concern should they become one of the chief supporters, and we had some interesting conversations about that before there was a decision that they would become one of the main sponsors as well.
To clarify, who is they?
U.S. Committee of the Ecumenical Decade.
I see.
There were about 27 of us, I think, who were members of that committee. Represented Latter-day Saints, represented most of the major denominations were represented. And then in Minneapolis, in the meantime, the Roman Catholics had bought into it. So that was really important to us. And in the end, we had a large group of lay women of the Catholic Church. Now, I don't mean nuns, I mean lay women in the pews. And they came to me at the end of the conference and said, "We want to search you out. We want you to understand this is the first time we feel we've been accepted in a major conference, and this has just changed our lives." That was really powerful, the last morning of the conference, that's one of those things that happened and you didn't know it was going to happen. And part of that was the planning committee in the Twin Cities had included so many Roman Catholics in the planning that, you know, it just became incredibly important.
As you were in that planning process, what were kind of the hopes, or were there any concerns? What were people thinking about the conference as it was taking shape?
Well, at first, I mean, it grew too. You know, at first we didn't think of it as being so large. And I think the concerns, there was some concern about some of the worship material that was being developed. I wasn't as aware of that. Mm. And it wasn't so much, it was Suicide Martin who was chairing that group. And it was just incredibly exciting. And the rules of the conference, in a sense, came out of that planning. And the local women could talk to you more about that, I think.
Sure.
Than I could, because I wasn't involved in their meetings. Afterward, I wish I had been, because I think it would have helped dispel some of the concerns about the language of the worship, sexuality, the images of sexuality that caused us more problems later.
Yeah.
You know, I'd still affirm them, but I think that we would have been able to see perhaps that some of the images were pretty graphic.
Yeah.
For the religious communities to deal with.
Yeah. Do you think if you'd been involved, you would have wanted to kind of tone them down a little bit, or?
I don't know. I think I would have been able to see what some of the later ramifications would be in the national church bodies.
Yeah.
And in presbyteries, for instance. Yeah, mm-hmm. I think. Because I was living, we and the women were living in a male-dominated structure. The church was trying, but still very, very male. And I think the presbyteries and this, we'd have had some knowledge that that was going to happen. I think that's one of the only things that I talked about later. In the conference as being of concern was one of the images.
Like, for example, the milk and honey ritual, for example.
The milk and honey ritual didn't bother us because we knew the difficulty of worshiping ecumenically in celebrating anything like the Eucharist. You can't do it in ecumenical circles. Because, you know, Roman Catholics, for example, don't celebrate the Eucharist with other denominations. And so the milk and honey ritual was fine. And it really was misrepresented totally.
Mm-hmm.
And a picture of me was sent out by the Presbyterian. I should say the Presbyterian layman was the group that attacked us from the beginning. And they had been trying, I was on their pages all the time, the director of the women's unit, because we were seeing criticized for our, we wrote a lot of materials on women in ordination, women in language. We'd written language about God, language of people of God, and they were very, very, very critical of anything like that, anything that smacked of feminism for them. And so I was already under attack by that group, and that's just what they needed. They had their cameras there, and they were all ready. And that was the first thing that came out that was part of their attack plan, was a picture of me at a round table. And what we were doing was saying goodbye to each other, and they used this to say it was milk and honey, and it was a substitute for communion, and how pagan it was. So that sort of became the head image of Marianne and her pagan group. in the Presbyterian layman. Yeah, and I knew this was happening on the last day of the conference. I knew we were going to be paying for it.
How did you know?
Well, for one thing, the woman who wrote all the articles and followed me all the time, was in all our meetings that they could get in terms of the women agenda. Her name was Susan Sire, and she followed me. She was the one who was assigned to just tag me all the time. And so I had been in conversations with her. I wouldn't say we learned to respect each other, but we acknowledged each other in meetings, national gatherings. And so she just followed me on. So she was following me even to the restroom and the Reimagining Conference. So I knew immediately. And the people at my table at the conference said, who is this person that keeps sticking this camera in her face? And I said, oh, that's a Presbyterian person. And you see, we had said we would not have cameras. We had made that decision. Not to have video or anything like that. So there they were taking pictures. So I knew by the end of the conference I was in deep trouble.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew that they would not, certainly not report it as it was. Mm-hmm. They would. And then I knew also that the gathering of the women in the conference around the lesbian issue and the whole issue of homosexuality, the leadership had called me from the table and said, come meet with us. We have to decide what we're going to do around the issue, because a group of lesbians who are here want to have some kind of acknowledgement that they're here. And so I went to that meeting with the leadership. I don't know whether Mary Kay or Kathy was there.
Mm-hmm.
I think there was only one of them who was there.
Mm-hmm.
And that had been a problem. It was a kind of hurried up, let's decide what we have to do.
Yeah.
And I had said, yeah, there should be some kind of recognition.
Mm.
So I knew when I did that, it was going to cause big, big problems for Presbyterians. But that was okay.
Yeah,
it was the right thing to do.
What I apologize. Apparently, I'm getting another call, and hopefully that will stop.
Okay.
And I'm not going to
hang up.
No. I think it will stop if I don't answer it. So we should be okay. I really want to know what led you, because that was quite a decision. What led you to affirm that decision about the lesbians? Yes. What led you to say yes to affirming the lesbian presence at the conference, knowing that it was going to cause so many problems?
Well, we in the women's unit have been dealing with the issue and all of the issues of inclusivity
mm-hmm.
on very many levels. And I knew that the women's unit we were together on that issue. There was never any question about that.
Mm-hmm.
And that the recognition of the presence, in a sense, was the same thing we as women had experienced in a male-dominated church, in churches, which was to make us invisible, and then we'd go away. So, you know, we were very much aware of being able to say, these are our sisters.
Yes.
They are with us. We are all one.
Yeah.
That was important. Just from what I was doing, what we were all doing in the women's ministry unit in the Presbyterian Church.
Mm-hmm.
And the church was coming to that, but it was pretty slow.
Mm. And Marianne, you've written some about this, but I would really love to hear about some of you. That's an important memory from the 93 conference. What were some of your other really strong memories of being there at that conference?
Well, I was very much around the table, you know,
yes.
just being a part of a group, and I was just thrilled from the minute I walked in. There were some funny things that happened. One of the funny things was that Sally, when I walked into the convention center the first night, Sally said, Marianne, I said, Sally, is there anything you need me to do? Because she just looked frantic. And she said, yeah, there is. You could do something for me. She said, I have a woman over here from the University of Michigan, and she says she will not sit at a table where there's a man, and mm-hmm. there is a man at her table. And she came to this conference. She will not share her life. You know, she just was very threatened by that. So I said, okay, do you want me to go talk? And she said, yeah, it's table 57 or whatever. Go see who it is, talk to him, and see if you can get someone else to trade this person. It put her at another table. So I walked into the table, and the person at the table was Dick Lundy. And so I said, Dick, there's a woman here who really can't be at a table with the man. I said, could I move you to a table? And I found Donna Blackstock, who wrote that paper that was so good. And I said, Donna, you need to go to this table. Will you exchange with Dick? And she said, well, yeah. I said, well, that's fine. Just do it as quietly as possible. And so and the next day, Donna came to me and she said, what was that all about? I never figured that out. So we succeeded in making everybody happy. Anyway, it was so funny. I just couldn't believe it when I went in and that was Dick sitting there.
I bet. Oh.
Yeah, Sally and I thought that was really the hand of God somehow.
Yes, yes. What other
memories? The conference itself, I was just so thrilled with it. I just couldn't get over it. It was just so incredible. And Mary Bednarowski was the first speaker. Oh, I just thought I used a lot of her material in that first speech when I went to the World Council of Churches later.
Yes.
And was asked to speak at various kinds of things. I just thought that was just a marvelous, marvelous beginning.
Yes.
If you've ever listened to her speech.
Yes, I have.
Yes. It's powerful about the women, the Jewish women who were together at the end of her. She talks about this, and I use that a lot in Europe.
Yes.
It was important. Worship was incredible. Sweet Honey in the Rock was just blew me away. And I hadn't known some of those pieces. And then I knew Nancy Chen, and I knew we tried to get her to do the art, but I didn't know quite how she was going to do that. And then it was just so powerful to have them doing the art at the same time we were all meeting.
Mm.
And, yeah, and then the whole opening was just, I thought it was a wonderful blend of kind of the usual women's hymns that were not that, Jane Parker Huberger, who was a good friend who'd written a lot of hymns in the Presbyterian Church. It was a blend, and then the Native American, the drums, and the Four Corners, sort of, going back and forth liturgy. It was so powerful. I just was walking on air. We were all so excited. And there were 19 of us from the women's staff and the other staff at the national level of the Presbyterian Church, and we were all just walking on air. We were just so excited. The one thing that I had gone to the communication department of the Presbyterian Church and said to the then acting director, we're having this major conference. It's going to be the major contribution of the Presbyterian Church. We need your reporters later. And she said, oh, well, I've got two more meetings. And they were still organizing as a department. And she said, we've got these General Assembly, one was a General Assembly Council Committee, another one. And she said, we need to cover those. And I've already assigned the reporters, and I don't have any more. And I said, look, this is really important. You really need to get a reporter there. And she said, oh, it's just a woman's meeting, isn't it? And I said, it's our most important meeting of the decade. And it's not just a woman's meeting. It's going to be the most influential meeting of the decade. Anyway, she said, well, I'll see what I can do. And she didn't. And that was one of the problems we had as a denomination, because the only communicators there was a Presbyterian layman, except that then Presbyterian Emmett, who published a magazine, and had very competent staff, realized that they were going to have to take over the communication role about the second day in. So they did write. They were the best ears and eyes we had to be there and to write.
I think I missed the name of that, Marianne. Who was that again who took it over?
The person who was the editor was Barbara Roach. It was the magazine of Presbyterian Women.
Okay.
Was, I don't know, and she's a good one to talk to, too.
Okay, good.
R-O-C-H-E.
Got it.
I think that's her name.
Okay.
I can't tell you where she is right now. She may still be in Louisville.
Okay.
But she did write a number of articles that, and she became very out front there in terms of speaking back to the layman about issues, even though that had not been her role, and speaking to the church.
Was she at the conference?
Yeah, oh yeah.
Uh-huh.
Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there were at least two other reporters from the Presbyterian Women's Magazine who were there too. It was called Concern at that point.
Okay, yes.
She was, and then the Episcopal Church had a reporter there that I really depended upon a lot for interpretation later, as well as the Lutherans.
Yeah.
ELCA. ELCA was being formed about that time, too.
Yeah.
And the women's directors there and I met several times because we were, especially after reimagining.
Yeah. Marianne, now we're talking about the backlash here. I know you were definitely affected personally, probably more than anyone. I know you've written some about this, but could you talk some about how what happened to you and how it happened?
Yeah, it's in and of itself a book.
Yes.
I knew right away, as I said to you, I went to have dinner with my family on the Sunday the conference ended, and both Dick and his wife Lucille had been one of the dancers in the group, and she said, they all said, Marianne, this is really going to cause trouble, isn't it? Aren't you going to be in trouble? I said, oh yeah, I think so. And it was the whole family. It was at lunch, and my kids were saying, well, what kind of trouble? What do you mean? You know, what do you mean, Mom? It was a women's conference. And right away we said, well, there were a lot of things that sort of, quote, broke the rules, quote, for a conference. And because I was so involved in forming the conference, in the idea of it, yeah. There's gonna be backlash, and I remember sitting there thinking, I can't eat any more of this lunch.
Oh.
I can't. We're eating. I can't. It's they're right, and if they recognize this is gonna happen, it's gonna be really bad. And so, to Louisville, and realized that it was gonna be really, you know, very difficult. And the group of us met right away. And the 20 of us who'd been, 19 of us who'd been at the conference, and we tried to analyze what could be the biggest problems, how could we respond, and then everything began to come in from everywhere.
Could you say a little bit more about what you thought at that time, what you thought the biggest problems would be and how you would respond?
I thought the worship language would be the biggest problems. And I knew the gathering, the public recognition of the lesbian group, the kind of affirmation, really, of homosexuality that the conference was given would be a problem. And the worship language, I was concerned about being able to defend as a liturgical language. And then...
Could I ask
I had been in the group, the morning or the afternoon that Dolores Williams had answered the question on the floor about the atonement that hit the fan. Mm. And it was hard to hear her because she didn't realize she was mic'd. She thought she was talking to this person just in question and answer.
Yeah.
And I knew that the minute that came over the mic, the whole question about the atonement was going to be a problem.
Yeah.
But I knew also that Dolores could defend herself.
Yes.
I'm not a lot. So I wasn't, I guess that one didn't bother me quite so much. And, you know, the question of the atonement's always questionable anyway. So, and she was right in terms of she'd been talking about the communities in churches, the black communities, the black churches, and the fact that, well, the quote is there.
Mm-hmm.
That's what she said, you know, we don't need any more bloody Jesus. And she talked about the fact that we didn't need to victimize and to lend credence to the idea that we were all victims in the Christian faith, in Christology. And so she, I didn't think so much about it at the time, but I did think, uh-oh. But then I thought, well, that's not a part of her speech. It wasn't part of her presentation.
Mm-hmm.
But it ended up not mattering.
Mm-hmm.
So those were some of the things. And then,
Marianne, I'm sorry to interrupt. Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry to interrupt. Could you say a little bit more about what about the worship language specifically? Had you concerned?
Well, mostly the references, the sexual images of women, the women's sexuality as a part of what we were proclaiming within the rituals.
Yes.
And particularly the one about we greet the lover's body, I can't quote it exactly, through the juices of our body. We take a lover indoors. So there's just one image there. I can find it if you need me to do that.
No, I know where that is. Yeah,
yeah.
You're absolutely right. Yep, yep.
And that was, I remember thinking as we said that, wow.
Yeah.
That's pretty graphic.
Yeah.
And can be seen to be pornographic rather than liturgical.
Mm-hmm.
But I still thought we could defend it, as women. On the other hand, I also knew that we'd had huge battles in the Presbyterian Church. We'd always won in terms of women's right to choose, women's reproductive freedom. The women's unit had been right in the middle of a lot of that.
Mm.
But we always had always won on those issues. We'd always taken a very important, in fact, I've been in several press conferences in Washington at least twice where the Methodist, head of the Methodists, the Jewish women, Hadassah, Presbyterian, we had talked to those issues, and we were very much one voice.
Mm-hmm.
So I you know, had the feeling, but it was still an uphill battle.
Yeah.
More of an uphill battle today, isn't it?
Yeah.
So I think that really jolted me, I think, the graphic images of women's sexuality.
Mm.
And I think that's the one, when I was asked nationally to make an apology for the conference, I refused, saying, well, how can I do that? It's the most important conference for women, and as the Christian Century said, in the last decade, the most important religious event in this country. And I said, you know, how can I take that back? That doesn't make any sense.
Mm-hmm.
Why would I apologize? I mean, it makes no sense. But that was the area, I think, the critics would say, well, if she just would apologize for some of those images, if she just apologized. And No, I refuse. How can I do that?
Yeah.
That would be to deny the conference. So, more graphic than that. Let's see. Well, the Sophia language, but that was so justifiable. I didn't worry about that. I just felt, you know, we were just right on target with the whole concept of wisdom and the feminine aspect of God. So. I didn't worry about that. I thought we could justify that. It did turn out to be one of the major critical points later.
Yeah.
I don't know, too. I was brought up on heresy charges.
Yes.
I don't know if you... That didn't come out anywhere.
Oh. Say some more about that.
I was charged with heresy. A local church can do that with a person... leadership in the church, particularly clergy, and they thought I was clergy, and so I would have been brought up differently as an elder of the church, an elected leader, but they threw it out finally. That we had a whole court system in the Presbyterian Church with a permanent judicial commission that sits on cases of theological question, and one of the lawyers, it happens to be a lawyer who came to me and said, "Marianne, don't worry about this. I think you'll be okay." And I said, "I'd be glad to talk about my theology. I think it would turn out that I'm really quite common, not at all crazy." But it never came to that point. The charges were thrown out by the Permanent Judicial Commission.
Were they thrown out for technical reasons, or what?
Yeah, it was. It was thrown out because I was a layperson.
Yeah.
And because they had not been clear about what their charges were. They were trying to use the conference, and they didn't tie it closely enough to my theology and what they could have charged me personally with. So I got off the hook on that one.
Yeah. Are you allowed to say or remember which local church it was, or is that confidential?
Yeah, it was in Wichita.
Wichita?
I think it's called Westminster Presbyterian Church in Wichita.
Okay, yep.
Maybe it was First Presbyterian, anyway.
Yeah.
And the General Assembly was to meet there in Wichita, and the whole conference was going to be evacuated.
Oh, right.
So it sort of all worked together.
Yeah. When we left off, and I apologize for that because I wanted to really clarify something, you were meeting with the 19 people who were there, the 19 women, and you were kind of addressing it?
Yeah, they've been from the national staff.
Yes, yes.
My colleagues from national staff in Louisville.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what happened from there?
Well, they met, as things got hotter and hotter, they met Jim Brown, who was the executive director of this General Assembly Council. But I should say, by the time the conference came, that's the other thing. By the time the conference took place, I had been made the associate director of the General Assembly Council of the Church, which meant I was the highest ranking woman in the church. In terms of governing, government. So that's also why, I think if I had been identified only as director of the Women's Unit, it would have been bad enough. But by then, Jim had moved me up to associate director. In fact, I'm quite sure that there still would have been lots of criticism.
Yeah.
And lots of criticism of the Women's Unit, but not quite as much. In fact, not quite as much. It just hit the whole church because I was seen as the associate director.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, that needs to be said. I keep forgetting that.
That's important. Yes, yes. Is this just to get to how you account for the backlash? That seems to be part of it. What are your, when you look at it, what led to that backlash?
Well, because the $66,000, essentially, I think, had the church not given the amount of money from the Bicentennial Fund, then a lot of the opposition would have been much, much less.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that that's our money going to that conference, I mean, it wasn't necessarily. There were lots of large gifts given by individuals as well as churches, but it was a major, major financial burst for the Presbyterian Church. And so people saw, I think that really was the big controversy. And the other part, we ended up having a when you do a financial, we had someone come,
an audit,
of all the money. Sally and I figured that out, and she was able to trace from the beginning. We said we had to keep the Christian money discreet in the sense of being able to trace it.
Yeah.
And so we could trace every penny of the $66,000, and say which, even to the point of saying which people had been funded to come.
Yes.
Which women theologians had been funded. So that was helpful. We were never, ever accused of misusing any of the funds.
Yes.
And I think that, but in a way, that word by then that hardly mattered. The other thing we did, we hired a woman actually a minister whose husband, well, I think, was a presbytery executive, offered to come and stay and go through all of the money that the churches were withholding. Which was set to be $4 million. Well, that turned out not to even be $1 million. She came and traced all the money, trying to find out which churches were already not giving their share to the national offices. And she was able to find out that it was about $500,000. And it was always questionable because a lot of the churches were withholding funds anyway because they're mad at the church. But this gave some of them a real reason to do that.
Why were they mad at the church? What were the issues already there?
Well, we had just joined the Southern Northern Church and the different politics that are involved in that. Yeah. So there were lots of issues that people were... There were different ways of doing things, and so it when something had to be decided, when you're putting all this together, there were always people who were unhappy at the presbytery level or at the in church, local churches, saying, "Oh, we don't have as much to say as we used to," or "Why are we supporting this?" or "What are we doing with that?" Presbyterians are very feisty when it comes to anything they disagree with. And so it was, we realized it just in the putting together churches without any conference, any woman's issues, it was a pretty tricky time anyway.
Mm.
And we were not that far into that. So that was part of just the dissatisfaction generally.
Mm-hmm. That's really important. Yeah. That's an important context for it.
Yeah, it was very important. And part of it was we were still making decisions on how to put it all together.
Yeah.
And, the Civil War still lives, right? In terms of the division between Northern attitudes and Southern attitudes.
Right.
And that was part of that whole division and discontent, I'd say, with the national body. body that was being formed.
Uh-huh.
It was still being tried.
Yeah. Yeah. So to get back to your experience, could you say some more about then what happened to you?
Yeah. I started getting awful, awful phone calls. Let me see what time it is. I don't know.
Yeah.
Quarter to 11.
Yeah.
I started right away getting phone calls from people who were upset, and I was trying to answer them first and then realized I couldn't, so I hired an extra secretary.
Wow.
I mean, it was just wonderful. She was an actress in the Louisville theater. It turned out to be perfect. She was so, she knew why she'd been hired, but she was really to take these awful phone calls, and she was to deflect them so that I wouldn't have to take them. And she got so good at it. She was so funny. And then every once in a while, she would come and say, we had 100 a day
somehow.
And she would come and say, I think you should take this one. That sounds like a good person. And so she really sort of sifted all the phone calls, you know, so that I just didn't have to. And I haven't had, but then people threatened me. There were church elders who called and said, you know what I'd do with you if I ever saw you? I'd take you down in the church basement and give you what you need. I mean, really awful, vulgar stuff. And so it was somewhat frightening in that sense.
Yes.
So she was able, and she took down what they were concerned about. Jim had a whole narrative was really helpful. And she was just so funny. And she could, I even forget her name, isn't that funny? Mm-hmm. Anyway, that helped a lot with my being one step removed. The other thing I should say was all the time I was going through this, the national staff was so supportive.
Mm-hmm.
I'd come in some mornings, I'm still getting emotional about it. I would come in and there'd be a rose on my desk,
oh,
or a card, or something like a hot cup of coffee, or people just, and they, most of the time I didn't even know who'd done it.
Oh.
So it was men as well. In fact, I got a lot of support from my male colleagues as well. So it was but my feeling, the thing I can remember back is I'm taking a shower in the morning. I'd feel like I had a black cloud over my head. If I could just stand there and wash long enough, the black cloud would be removed.
Oh.
And I'd come out every day and think, oh, it's still there.
Oh.
It was I know that sounds so simple and so, you know, kind of naive, of course, but that was one way of dealing with what was so graphic. So,
yeah.
Awful. Deal with all that. But I must say, my colleagues on the national staff were just—I think all of them were supportive.
Mm-hmm.
Some didn't. Some less didn't understand. Still thought women were, you know, it was much too. I know a lot of them don't know it was much too. Some of them, I shouldn't say a lot of them, felt it was just over the hill, too far.
Yeah.
And then I should say the General Assembly Council did an evaluation of me, of my work, as a associate director. And it was an effort to say, should we fire Marianne or not? And it came at the, well, the first thing was, should we do a major evaluation of Marianne Mundy? And it was, came out 33-32.
Wow.
And so they decided they couldn't do that, wouldn't be an evaluation, but then the General Assembly had a task force to evaluate the whole reimagining and my role. And that came, I had already been fired right before that General Assembly, but I insisted on going. said, they're going to have to face me.
Wow.
And the assembly report was very positive. Mm. It said, you know, we should, this was an ecumenical conference. That was the other thing that kept being just so frustrating, this, for Presbyterians to act like this was their conference and not an ecumenical conference. And we'd always supported ecumenical gatherings very strongly. Part of the theology of being a Presbyterian. And so that was very frustrating because people would write as though that we owned the conference. It was our conference, Presbyterians. And we just had to keep saying over and over and over. And we wrote information sheets that we sent out to all the presbyteries and dealing with Sophia and the worship language. And I have some, if you don't have any of those, you should see one of those too that we sent out.
Thank you.
And Jim Brown was very, Jim Brown is here in Santa Fe. We both live here now.
Oh.
And was the executive director. And he was very supportive of me and tried hard to kind of keep it together in the National Church until he finally decided that it was too much of a division in the church. It was going to split the church and my staying. And so he came and reissued a joint statement. It didn't, under personnel policies of the Presbyterian Church, I couldn't say I'd been fired. We said under, because I forget what this was, but it was related to Mary Ann Lundy has found she can no longer be effective in her position as associate director. And so that was a very short statement that was issued. And then everybody didn't, you know, wanted to know, was she fired or wasn't she? Did she just leave? And so that became a whole conversation in the Presbyterian Church. You know, did she leave? Was she? That was very hard for all of us because we just couldn't say.
How did you feel at that point about that? That this.
Oh,
that
was,
yeah.
I was devastated because Jim had tried over and over again, and I think really earnestly to say she's a good colleague. She's done her job, and my job was church-wide partnerships between the presbyteries, the synods, the whole church, the structures of the church. So that was my job, was working on partnerships of funding, programming nationally. And I had meetings that I was responsible for, I think about four times a year. And so he was really trying to say, you know, these things are, and the 16 synod executives, who were all men, voted in support of me.
Wow.
And said, you cannot fire her. This is not about the work she's done or the work the church is doing. This is the right-wing attacks. And that came about 3 weeks before then. He came back from a presbytery meeting in on the West Coast, a very conservative presbytery, and said, it's gonna be worse. It's gonna get worse. You've got to go. So that was it, and I was just devastated. But you know, that was, I suppose, in lots of ways, I knew it was a possibility. Of course. And at the same time, I was doing all these things. I was being interviewed by ABC, and they did a thing. I happened to be away. It was in Florida for a week. And so there's a film of that on a beach in Florida with one of my oldest YWCA friends. It got a lot of more comment because the right wing said I was just trying to get sympathy. That I just looked bad because I was trying to get sympathy. It was just, Rita Nakashima Brock did a good job on that one. She took up that cause. And then Ted Koppel did a thing, but that was, I think, with Rita. And Oh, and Susan Sire, the woman that attacked me.
Yeah.
And then I was did my PBS at General Assembly, which was really hard because there's so much stuff going on. And Richard, I can't think of his name, he was the religion person. And he was a Roman Catholic, and I had a hard time helping him understand what the conference is about. Mm. I remember being very frustrated about it.
Mm.
And so it came out to be a very short piece because I hadn't done very well, and I certainly hadn't helped him. I didn't think I'd helped him understand this at all.
Mm.
And it was, yeah, it was a really hard time. Anyway, then, let's see. Finally, I was gone. Have we gotten to that part? Yeah, we have.
Mm. I did want to, earlier you had said something, would you say something about that small Burgess paper that came out?
Yes, that went to all the presbyteries. Mm-hmm. It didn't go to all the churches. I think it went to all the presbyteries.
It
made some statements. Well, if you, as you said, you read Donna Blumstock's paper and refuted it.
Yes.
And I was just furious with them because they didn't show it to me ahead of time. I didn't even know it had gone out until I learned about it from local churches and local presbyteries. And it just was so unfair because it gave none of us a chance. None of us, the national staff, their colleagues, to say anything. Mm. And it was just wrong in some places.
Mm.
So it was, and they really had done it with no, I still don't know what the motivation was.
Mm. What was their role? I mean, what was their, they had a position?
They were on the national staff in theology and worship.
Okay.
And they set themselves up as theologians that knew better than the rest of us.
Yeah. And when you said they got some of it wrong, do you recall what it was that they got wrong?
Well, if you read Donna's paper, I was reading that yesterday.
Yes.
The nuances of the Sophia.
Yes.
They knew better than some of the things they said in that paper. I'm sorry, I'd have to have the paper in my hand.
Yeah.
And then it was the theology. I don't know anymore.
Yeah.
I have to go back and
sure.
look at it.
But you would say that Donna really gave a good response that you would agree with to their.
Oh yeah. And Donna's paper was sound theologically. She'd been at the conference and in several places. I think in three places she says they didn't understand because they weren't even there. They didn't even hear those words.
Yeah.
They didn't, you know. So she felt that it needed to be critiqued by somebody who was there.
Yes.
So that was a part of her. And then just taking things too far in some cases. But I'm sorry, I really need to go back.
Sure. Oh, understandable. Yes. Yeah. You were saying, did you want to pick up where you were leaving off there about the firing?
Yeah, well, it was confidential. I couldn't talk about it. I was invited at the General Assembly to speak at the PHGWA, which is Presbyterian Health Education Welfare. It's been one of the radical groups in social justice. And I really thought this is a chance for me to say something, but I can't by the personality or the personnel policies. I had signed the statement that I was not to talk about it. So finally I thought of something. It was a whole set of things saying, do you believe, how did I say it? I said it was questions. Check your assumptions. I had a colleague in campus ministry once who kept saying to me, Mary Ann, check your assumptions. Every time we've gotten wrong, check your assumptions. So I thought, aha, check your assumptions that every person who stands up for gay persons your assumption. And I just wrote down a whole line of things. And it was, check your assumption that Marianne Lundy was fired. And it just sort of, a whole, it turned out to be a good way to be able to say, okay, just question that.
Yeah.
So,
Because would you, just to clarify, so what would you say about that? That you were fired?
I couldn't say anything.
Yeah. But that was the truth, but you weren't allowed to say it.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That little statement that said, James Brown has issued a statement today that Marianne Lundy is no longer able to carry out the duties of her. I've got the statement somewhere, but
yes.
It's no longer able to carry out her ministry, her leadership in a way that makes it effective. That way. I remember the word effective a minute too.
Yes.
Yeah, I can find the statement.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, I've seen the statement. I can go back and look at that, Marianne.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, and it was a pretty neutral statement.
Mm-hmm.
And we were both crying by the time we issued it.
Really?
Pretty poignant, yeah.
Wow. What did you think of the report that came out of the General Assembly about...
Well, I actually thought it was good. I thought they tried to be as neutral as possible.
Mm-hmm.
The person who chaired that committee is the editor of the Christian Century now.
Oh.
John, this is so funny. He was just here and I blocked his name.
Yeah.
I thought they did well. There were some things I wish they had stressed a bit more, I remember at the time. But when the report came out, it said that we are ecumenical. This was an ecumenical event. It was not a Presbyterian event. It talked about that they had found nothing in my leadership and that the people, that we should affirm the people who were there. It was trying to say there was nothing, the fact that it was an ecumenical event meant we didn't control it, and that we should continue to be involved in ecumenical events and continue to sponsor them.
Mm-hmm.
The only question that I think it raised about whether we could affirm the thing that happened at the conference.
Right.
And then they did say there was something also related, because I remember being very concerned that they weren't talking to the layman about what they had said that wasn't incorrect, in their wanting to, assassinate the people who'd been there. And I had hoped they'd be a little more. And later, they set up a fund for having conversations with the Presbyterian layman, and that, I think they had three conferences, and then they gave up on it, because you just couldn't talk with them.
Wow.
It was about the differences in the church and what they were critical of. And it was just a fiasco, really, because they would not agree to have open conversation, really.
Yeah.
So, and Presbyterian Layman has folded now. After it started in 1962, when Eugene Carson Blake was the stated clerk of our church, and he was later the secretary of the World Council of Churches, and he had integrated a park in Baltimore, and that's when the layman started its great mission of taking down national staff.
Really? Oh,
yeah.
I did want to go ahead.
It was a kind of spurious intent, and it was always aimed at national staff.
Mm-hmm. There was a line in the report about not being in line with Reformed theology.
Yeah, which I think was very unfortunate. in the report that came back.
Right.
And yet that everything in an ecumenical event, when they spoke to the report, everything in an ecumenical event will not be in line with Reformed theology. Mm. But I can't remember. I think that was, you know, that was a line that I never quite figured out what they were talking about. Do you have that in front of you? Can you?
I don't, but I could get that later.
Well,
yeah.
And I can find it too. I just remember that somebody took a picture of some of us on the national staff hugging each other and crying when that report came in. The sad part of that whole thing was, after the report came in, there were, and I learned this later at a conference actually at Vanderbilt, there had been three commissioners to the General Assembly who wanted to issue a statement about gratitude for my leadership in the Presbyterian Church, and they were told they could do that.
Mm.
And particularly one was a professor at Pittsburgh Seminary, and I met with Ron later, and he was the one who told me that they had worked this out, and they were told they could be, this would be fine, that they could issue a statement just thanking me for my leadership and stating what my leadership had been. And every time they stood up, they were called out of order.
Mm.
And so they never did. They were never able to get the overture or the statement of gratitude onto the floor. And the conference I was in later with Ron Peters, he was furious, just furious still, months after this, because he's an African-American young professor then at Pittsburgh Seminary. And he was just, he felt like, you know, this was another case where women and people of color were counted out.
Mm.
So it was it's kind of a private matter because people don't know very much about it.
Yeah.
But I was really sad about that.
Yeah.
Not for me, but for him.
Yeah. Marianne, I'm aware that we've been talking for a while now, and you have generously offered to continue the conversation. Should we communicate by email and set up another time? Because important, and there's so much here. And if you're willing to talk again, that would be such a gift.
I'm willing to do that, sure.
Good.
In fact, do you want to try another Monday?
Yes, that would work great, sure.
Hang on, I think I can do the 23rd, because we'd set aside two.
Right.
Two different. Yeah. So
good.
I could do that the 23rd.
Good. And with the same.
Let's try for 10 o'clock.
10 o'clock? Which time?
The trouble, that's noon with you. You'll have to bring a sandwich.
Okay. I'm fine with that. Actually, I think I'm only an hour ahead. So it'd probably be 11 my time. Is that right?
Pardon?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, we're just an hour different.
Okay. Yeah. So 11 o'clock my time, 10 o'clock your time.
That would be great. I'm almost losing my voice here.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's been a lot.
It's funny, too. There's still so much emotion in this.
Oh, yes.
I'm always surprised at that.
Yeah.
You know? It's been 20-some years, my goodness.
Yeah. But it was huge for you and for everyone. Yeah, especially for you.
Yeah. Okay, good. The 23rd at 10 o'clock.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
I have your phone number if anything happens. So. Okay.
Good. Thank you so much, Marianne.
Thank
I really appreciate
you. I'm glad. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.